I'm going to ask each of you, and then I will as well, to introduce yourselves a little in terms of your practice with kids. And I even maybe tell us a story about a kid you saw to give people a sense of the kind of work that we all do. You want to go first,
Great.
Chris?
Sure. My name is Chris Willard. So I'm a clinical psychologist. I work primarily with kids and adolescents and young adults, mostly one-on-one in the work that I do, kind of helping kids struggling with mental health issues, anxiety, depression, dealing with stress, sometimes kind of overlapping with Mark's work in terms of dealing with learning issues as well. And a lot of what I try to do is integrate mindfulness and basically one-on-one mindfulness teaching into some of my sessions. And that can look really different depending on the specific kids that I'm working with. So sometimes it's maybe actually taking some time and closing our eyes and listening to the bell, or maybe it's just being a little bit more mindful of everything that we're doing kind of throughout the session as we're playing. And one of the ways I explain mindfulness to kids is it's really just being aware of what we're doing and knowing that we're doing it is a way I kind of like to explain it to kids without being quite so reactive. So that can look different for different kids, as I said. So had a kid who was struggling a lot with anxiety around going to bed, anxiety around kind of going on a big field trip. We spent a number of months kind of building up to that with some short mindfulness practices, breathing practices, visualization practices, kind of building up the muscle so that he could really use his mindfulness practices when he was, finding himself getting a little bit more anxious, being really able to practice when he did have that overnight field trip that he had. So that's some of what I do. I also do a lot of consulting to different schools about ways they can bring more mindfulness into their curriculum and into their counseling departments, as well as into their roles as educators and classroom educators.
Thanks. So I'm a developmental pediatrician. I think, is volume good? Good. So I'm a developmental pediatrician, and in my day-to-day clinical work, I'm working with a lot of children with developmental differences of different kinds, learning disabilities, ADHD, and autism. And one of the things that really interests me is just making this sort of larger concept of mindfulness kind of practical, because I think really in the end that the mindfulness we can define lots of different ways, but it's really about just living life in a particular way. So if you want to talk about examples of how mindfulness can be really useful around something like ADHD, part of why I even started talking about mindfulness and ADHD just in a related way is just the recognition that parenting is really, really stressful. And parenting a child with developmental differences is, amazingly enough, there's research on it, because in case you needed to prove it, but it turns out that that's even more stressful. And I sort of became more and more aware of just how much that stress impacts, it makes it hard to do the things you need to be doing. So you're going to see people who are giving you all this advice about how to manage different problems, and it's really emotionally charged, and it's really difficult to stick to what you're being asked to be done. The behavioral plans are hard. So when it comes to just like how I use mindfulness day-to-day in my practice, sometimes I really don't even call it mindfulness initially. One of the ways mindfulness is sometimes described in part is just something called non-judgmental awareness, which just means, again, that term doesn't quite capture, I think, in everyday life. It's a little bit what Chris was saying of how we spend so much of our lives kind of like on autopilot, being really reactive to these different things that are going on, because we like them or don't like them or wish they weren't there. And it starts just sending us all over the place in ways that aren't always, really that helpful. So often one of the starting places, for example, for me in working with ADHD, which is another thing we can talk about later. I mean, one of the interesting things to me about ADHD is that the research of it in many ways is kind of like the antithesis of the research in mindfulness, so that with mindfulness, some of the research talks about a topic called executive function and how building executive function helps with resilience in life and problem solving in life. And there's all these long-term studies that are really interesting. And the research in ADHD kind of shows the opposite. I mean, ADHD at its heart is a developmental delay in executive function, and kids struggle in many of the same areas. So when it comes to just like how do you use mindfulness, so to speak, it's more of a perspective than anything. And one of the simplest starting points for ADHD to talk about, but it's very hard to do, is just to start to really try to see things as they are. So you're wrestling. This one comes up all the time. You know, the morning routine is a complete disaster. You know, every day you're fighting and your child's off task and they get distracted. And for anyone who doesn't know what living with ADHD is like, you know, those are all just core ADHD symptoms. But on a practical level, what's going on is you might have a 9 or 10-year-old whose actual skills are more like a 5 or 6-year-old. And so part of the way this whole field of child development can relate to something like ADHD is just helping people, you know, helping parents deal with the fact that, you know, seeing for that for what it is, just accepting it for what it is, meaning both sides of the coin. That for the child, you know, one of the solutions to helping them through the morning is recognizing that just like if they had a language delay, their skills are behind. And it may look willful and it's a pain in the rear and it's really difficult in 100 different ways, but that's where their skills are. And if we're going to come up with solutions, we need to see that clearly. And then the flip side is being just as honest with your experience as a parent, that accepting it doesn't mean I'm okay with it. Accepting it means recognizing, like, this is stressful and overwhelming and taking a lot of effort, and, you know, I need support too because this isn't easy stuff. So when you look at, like, how you can use mindfulness day to day, it's really beginning to work with things maybe a little differently and just fully being open to both sides of the experience. And the more accurately you can see it, you know, the quicker you can come up with an, you know, a plan. You couple it with the actual ADHD plan and then say, like, okay, that's really challenging. Now what are we going to do about it?
And I'm a general pediatrician. I see kids who are, you know, part of my job as a general pediatrician is to be alert for all of the conditions that you've been talking about for the kids who are struggling, really struggling, need more expert help, the families who are not just having your average horrible morning routine, but where something's actually going on where the kids and the parents need more help. So I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking both about the question of keeping an eye out for the families where you do have developmental differences, ADHD, other issues getting in the way. But I'm also thinking about just in the everyday scrum of trying to be a parent of either young children or older children, what are the ways that it should be my job to try to help and support and give parents some guidance which will make them feel not judged, but recognized and supported. And it's not an easy job. And one of the things which you're making me think about, in fact, is that a lot of the families that come into the clinic, even coming, I don't know about going to your office, it may be that it's lovely and there are soothing colors, but by the time a lot of the families get in to see us, they've already had an unusually stressful day. You know, getting to us, waiting for us, worrying the child is coming to the end of his patience and is going to misbehave in front of the pediatrician and, you know, give the suggestion that this family does, you know, this parent doesn't know what she's doing, and so on and so on. And I'm thinking about just the actual moments where right. We're talking and they're there and we're watching the child and how fraught that can be.
Yep.
I'm going to ask you both to come back. You used a couple of different terms, as
sure.
You mentioned. You talked about mindfulness. You talked about resilience or resiliency. I'm never sure which is the noun. And you talked about executive function. And you don't have to do this in turn. You can help each other. But right. Can you sort of define what you mean and how those, at least those three entities relate to each other? Mm-hmm. And if you wouldn't mind, given that we're developmentalists, a little bit about age span, that what do we mean when we talk about those qualities in a 3-year-old? What do we mean when we talk about those qualities in a 9-year-old, a 15-year-old?
Right. So, I mean, the whole topic, how many people here are familiar with the topic of executive function? I'm just curious. I mean, it's becoming something that people are becoming very familiar with. And one of the most important things, I think, to understand about child development is that executive function itself is a developmental path. So that, you know, what executive function is more or less our capacity to self-manage or self-regulate. It's all the skills we bring to kind of organizing and planning. And really, the simplest way to think about it is executive function is like the CEO of the brain or the conductor of an orchestra. So it turns out that part of our brain had to evolve to kind of keep track of the big picture. It's sort of not any specific like what we know or how hard we're trying even, which we'll talk about around motivation and resilience. But it's a developmental path just having to do with management skills. And that has to do with attention and behavior, but also organizing and time management. So one of the reasons it's really important to understand executive function, which I want to try to stay a little concise, is that, you know, early measures of executive function, and maybe we'll touch on the studies in a little bit, really correlate with lifelong measures of success. And, you know, there's several different studies which are really fascinating to look at where you can catch a snapshot of a child's ability to self-manage in the preschool age, and it tends to predict things out, you know, 10, 20 years. Now, you know, and I know, I think Perry and I have touched on this before, it's like that's a trend. So for kids who aren't on that path, most of them are going to do just great. But if you look at a group of kids, that turns out to be true. So when you talk about it as a developmental path, you know, in really young kids, it's just starting. So when you look at, like, why do three-year-olds need to be, you know, does behavior management need to be very different in a three-year-old than a 16-year-old? It's in large part because part of executive function is time and being able to connect now with before, you know, and it relates to research having to do with things like putting yourself in the perspective of somebody else. And when you tie all, oh, please, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, so you talked about the difference between a three-year-old and a 16-year-old, and you work with adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
So what does executive function mean for adolescents?
Well, I think adolescents are certainly capable of more. I mean, a three-year-old, for example, is really incapable of making, you know, we give them a set of decisions to make, and this is one of the things that we do in our sort of paradox of choice culture, you know, do you want this, or this for dinner? That actually is quite overwhelming for a three-year-old and actually is really taxing and kind of wears out their executive function system. They get exhausted. It actually makes them more cranky, more emotional. So I think also kind of giving kids sort of developmentally appropriate choices, that kind of thing, just as they go along until they start reaching adolescence, giving them opportunities to practice their executive function skills that they can get to adolescence, at which point hopefully they have a reasonable set of executive function skills intact for that.
Well, the
girls
do.
Yeah. But do you, yeah.
That's, well, right.
And do you want to comment on, or do you want me to comment on the difference between the 16 and 26-year-olds?
Right. And so one of the things we know about executive functions or about, you know, where they're located, which is largely in the prefrontal cortex, that's an area that it's kind of what makes us human. It's the last part, you know, to that kind of evolved to make us human beings. It's also the last part of the brain to really develop. So we used to think it was kind of done at 16 or 18. Now we know it's more like, you know, 24, 25. We know even for young men that it's more like 28 or 29, which probably comes as no surprise to anyone in the room.
Right. But the implications of that being that, you know, one of the reasons we have to treat teens different than adults is because executive function is sort of the heart of judgment and planning and thinking of the future. And I think, you know, this is why this path is so important to understand, because teenagers are certainly way more mature than a 3 or 4 year old, and yet their executive function, their planning ability, isn't going to mature until they're in their mid-20s.
All right, so now resiliency or resilience. Mm-hmm. What do we mean? I have to tell you, it's a huge word in pediatrics, in the sense of, instead of just talking about the negatives, let's, you know, protect children from the many adverse events and traumas that can hurt them. Let's talk about what we can do to foster resiliency so that no matter what the world throws at them, they have some of the skills that they need to cope. But that, saying that doesn't mean that we all know exactly what we mean. And so, I mean, I can give you, it wouldn't surprise you. Oh, sure. I mean, you've heard several references to the work that I do with Reach Out and Read, which is about encouraging parents of kids, and especially in clinics that serve low-income and at-risk kids, encouraging reading aloud and giving books at the visit and helping parents see what are the age-appropriate ways to look at a book with a 6-month-old, a 1-year-old, a 2-year-old, a child who doesn't have language yet. And that does many things, and it helps foster rich vocabulary and familiarity with print. But the truth is that what it also does is it fosters interactive, language-based, positive parent-child relationships, which we think have a great deal to do with giving children. The language in pediatrics now is that you can buffer some of the stress and adverse events of childhood. You, as a child, it can be buffered by loving parental interactions, or another way to say that would be your family could be under tremendous stress, but hearing the familiar book at bedtime as a child could give you the sense that things were in the right place. And I just have to tell this story because the knitting was mentioned years ago. I mean, that's probably my only meditative practice. Years ago, I was allowed to write a column about knitting in the hospital for the New York Times. It was back in the days of the HERS column, which some of you may remember. And they didn't want me to write it because it was like too much a traditional women's page topic, knitting. But I kept saying, I promise you'll get angry letters. I promise it'll be controversial. I'll write about, you know, knitting at work and how the surgeon got mad at me. And anyway, so I did. And it got a huge number of letters. But one of the letters I've never forgotten was from someone who had been a child during the Second World War in London, and he'd been in the underground train stations with the bombs falling, and he remembered watching his grandmother knit, and he would fall asleep watching her knit, knowing that even though everything else was scary, as long as his grandmother was sitting by the cot knitting, the world was okay. And I think of that sometimes when I think about the story at bedtime for the child who wants that reason. So that's an example, I would say, for me, of what resilience might mean in young children, mm-hmm. how you mm-hmm. might help parents foster it with routines.
I think, you know, the one-line definition of resilience, I think, is just the capacity to bounce back from adversity. And, yeah, I think there's many, many different things that can help foster resiliency. You know, part of what I like, I mean, I also think it, sometimes thinking of childhood that way just simplifies things a lot, because some of those things are really the basics, like consistent caregiving and stable homes, and, you know, and you want to get into all these, you know, there's always somebody selling the next cutting edge something that's going to cure our kids of something else, but, you know, the basics still hold often, and some of the fundamentals of resiliency are built, you know, through just being with kids in different ways, and reading is, you know, certainly one of them. As a joint activity in that way. And we can talk about knitting as meditation later too if we want. But the reason it overlaps with the, you know, all these concepts overlap, just to tie them together, is executive function is kind of the skills you use to problem solve, in essence. It's the skill, you know, so they're complementary. You know, one is relates to concepts like grit and mindset and all these, you know, again, there are these books that are out now talking about them, and they're great in talking about the side of development that has to do with persistence and bouncing back. And then there's other things you need too, which are like the skills to actually deal with the problems, and that's kind of the executive function side of things.
And I think also part of resilience is, as we try to protect our kids from so much, is sometimes letting them fail, letting them have a hard time, letting them struggle, but also then giving them the skills kind of externally that they can then internalize. How do you process that failure? How do you process that struggle? How do you think your way through it? And also use your emotions to kind of give you some information to help guide you through that to the other side, whether it's the B minus on the test or the skin knee or the first heartbreak or all these other kind of inevitable things are our kids are going to face. But I think part of what's happened in terms of kind of the last few generations is there's been a kind of this, people probably are somewhat aware of this sort of focus on self-esteem, which has come, which is not itself a problem, but it's become a problem when it's sort of at the expense of helping kids be more resilient, learn from their own mistakes and all of that, which is what they really need, or a large part of what they need as well.
I should just say there should be some file cards out there, and if you think of questions while we're talking, please write them down. We'll collect them and try to answer as many as we can, or at least discuss them. So just to say that. Anyway, back
Thanks.
To...
No, that's great. No, I mean, I think I said, like Chris, I often feel like, you know, the opportunity to have frustration and challenges and not succeed from within a really stable home, a warm, loving home, is an opportunity. It's part of, you know, to be allowed to work through stuff and not always be successful is, you know, is a good thing in childhood.
So how do you operationalize that in practice? And I guess let me ask a question. I mean, I none of these words existed when I was growing up. Whatever my parents did for me, and they did a lot, they were not thinking mindfulness, they were not thinking resiliency, and they probably were not thinking executive function. I have to be honest here, since I have a grown-up child in the audience, probably never heard the word mindfulness, probably never heard the word resiliency, and probably if you heard the word executive function, it was just a negative comparison to your sister. Can you sort of talk about trying to do this in the exam room with parents, trying to sort of help them foster sure. these qualities? Or to yeah. put it another way, what did our parents do for us that made us the mindful, resilient, high-functioning people we all think we are?
I think they sent us outside and then fed us when we came home.
Okay.
Do you want to go first? Do you want?
Yeah, I think that's largely a part of it. I think kind of having, mindfulness, for example, for one thing, I think of as being, something like a mental exercise that's somewhat akin to physical exercise. We used to naturally get physical exercise running around, being in the woods, whatever, all that stuff as a kid. I don't want to get too much into how much better things were in our childhoods because our kids don't really want to hear that. But also mindfulness. We'd spend time just staring at the sky or looking at a fire or looking at the stars in the night sky or whatever it might be. And now we kind of unfortunately have to make a little bit of time for that. But those are a couple of the examples. And even just downtime that's not with a screen. There's that Times article a couple of months ago about like what happened to time for reflection. Any time that I could be just reflecting, and I'm quite addicted to my phone. I pull it out, check the Times, check Twitter, check, whatever it is. That's time I could be actually digesting, reflecting, thinking things through a little bit more. And that's not great for my executive function. It's not great for my emotional regulation. It's not great for my self-awareness. And certainly not for our kids.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a combination of two things. I mean, one is some of it is just simply that the same old stuff still holds true, and the world is getting busier and crazier and putting demands on kids that are developmentally, pulled out of thin air. So on the one, I think some of what we're talking about is almost like a pushback as a parent of how you can help kids. So so some of it is just looking at, trying to step past the trends into what we know about child development. And some of that can be very practical. Like, for example, overly academic kindergarten programs are linked to overdiagnosis of ADHD because your developmental expectations are off. So some of it has to do with that. And some of it goes beyond that, though, to just a better understanding of how the brain develops. And just, there's a concept in brain development that didn't exist or they didn't talk about when I was in medical school, which is neuroplasticity, which is just the brain is really on a literal level remapping itself constantly based on experience. That's why, probably why habits are so hard to change. So, some of it is like parenting trends come and go and they're just going to keep coming and go forever. But some of it really is a better understanding of brain development. And one of the more interesting ones has to do with research around mindfulness, which really suggests that, two things. One is through this specific practice, we can build skills that help us manage the challenges of life. So that's a practice. But I think the bigger concept is that same body of research looks at, what else can we do? Because mindfulness touches on things like, what else can we do to build focused attention? And what else can we do to build emotional awareness? Or what else can we do to build compassion? Or whatever we want to work on. And that doesn't have to be, mindfulness practice specifically. But the interesting thing is it is a new body of research so that a lot of it was what parents did, well-meaning parents did all through the years, and now we have this additional way to look at it, I think.
So you brought up school curriculum and can talk about things that you see in your practice or in your work around both what gets in the – I'm looking for what are the challenges that you see for parents and how you help them take the first steps. And let's start with schoolwork, homework. Because that's come up a couple of times, that B minus on the test,
right. That
homework assignment. What's getting in the way for the families you see, and what do you do to help parents help their kids?
Go first.
I mean, it's very challenging. I mean, I work in some pretty high achieving oriented suburbs with professional high achieving parents who are academics or leaders in what they do and have high expectations of their kids. There's nothing wrong with having really high expectations of our kids, and I want to, absolutely kind of make that clear, but it's kind of how we communicate, what it is that we're, how we communicate what our real values are to our kids, and that's partly by living them. I think in our schools also, thinking about, how much we're over-scheduling our kids, how much we're teaching to the test. I mean, this is all stuff we kind of inherently know, and even just kind of how much I was struck recently, I was doing some writing about games, and I was just thinking back on childhood and things we'd play in school, like Simon Says and Mother May I and all these other games, and I was thinking, oh, those weren't just games. Those were teaching executive functions. They were teaching impulse control. They were teaching careful listening. But as we decide in all of these schools, no more time for games. Recess is cut in half. Let's just go right to prepare for the test, prepare for the test, prepare for college, prepare for college, and overschedule our kids, they don't get that chance to actually, that's where they can practice those executive function skills. It's not just on writing a paper, it's on playing Mother May I, it's on, you know, playing other games that they enjoy playing, and also being aware of how much we're overscheduling our kids. I had a mom a couple of years ago, and she had her 16-year-old scheduled into 15-minute increments every afternoon. And she said, where do I fit in mindfulness? And I was like, forget mindfulness, you know, like let him just go outside and play, because this is, you know, that's more of what he needs than another thing kind of jammed into his schedule. Right.
This is your 15 minutes of mindfulness. We're behind. Right, no.
But I think another way to look at it, though, in terms of managing things like homework and schedule, is recognizing that, you know, teens are teens. They're not mature adults, which means that they're going to, you know, that even in a high-achieving community where it's easy for the teens themselves, like they want to please and they want to get somewhere, so they get caught up in, you know, they're not always being overscheduled. They're overscheduling themselves sometimes. And I think recognizing that they, you know, they're teens. They still need us to guide them in making good choices about their schedule and making good choices about their school. And also sometimes in the real specifics of scheduling. And that goes all the way into elementary school too, where the homework loads can get, you know, way more than, you know, the national recommendation for homework isn't, the actual recommendation is as best as it's ever studied. It's hard to nail down, around 10 minutes per grade, you know, as a maximum per night. And, you know, schools aren't really following that. So if you're going to, you know, you have a child whose organizational self-management skills are immature, you know, one of the most important things we can do for them is just help teach them how to manage it by setting up clear homework routines and helping them schedule their time and helping them plan up until they pick up that skill from us. And that goes all the way through high school for some kids. You know, they might be incredibly demanding high schools. We certainly, around here, there's plenty of them. And they might be academically capable of doing all the work, but really need a lot of support just in terms of how to manage that work, because that's typical development, because that's what we have to expect of them. You know, we can't expect them to manage it or make choices like an adult would.
And I think one of the things that happens for smart kids of high-achieving parents is they're sort of expected to pick that stuff up along the way. Like, oh, they're picking up math fine, they're picking up reading fine, but we're not. But that's also because we're teaching it to them. We're expecting that they're going to pick up the executive function skills. Not all of them are if we don't teach it to them.
Yeah. And some of the small things, like just family meals, have been, you know, correlated with lots of nice things in teens. So just keeping the basics in place of, like, we're going to prioritize through our own actions, you know, we can prioritize family meals and downtime and putting our own smartphone away at the dinner table so that, you know, we're all giving each other our full attention. And, you know, all those details add up, I think.
So I think we sort of keep touching on screen time and then, you know, coming back to it and moving away from it. But maybe we should talk about that, you know, and maybe we should start, as you did, by talking about in our lives as adults. And I mean, certainly for me as a pediatrician, I'm not horrified if I walk into the room and the teenager is on her smartphone. I sort of expect that. When the parent won't actually look up from the smartphone, I find that more off-putting.
I don't remember who did the survey, but there was a survey recently that I think the number was 70% of kids think their parents need to be on their phones less. And of course it goes top down. There's also, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, which is a great nonprofit out of Boston. And every year they do it's called the Toady Awards, the Totally Obnoxious Advertising Driven Youth Award. And within the last couple of years, one of the things that won was one of those toddler standing toy things, which had an iPad mount built into it. So that's the level of stuff we're dealing with.
Over my son's changing table? Is that?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's, I'm sure, yeah.
But I mean, so, I think, with something we were talking about earlier, though, which comes up, is the question that which comes first? I mean, when you see a kid who is really getting an enormous amount of screen time and is a very difficult kid, one of the things I always think about with the recommendations that we make in pediatrics is, with some children, some recommendations are much easier to follow than others, right? The sort of some whatever it is that we're asking you to do with your child, whether it's sleep or limits on food, I mean, there or limits on screen time. There are some children for whom it works beautifully, and those of us who happen to have those children congratulate ourselves on being wonderful parents. And the people who are struggling with the child who is the terrible sleeper, and man, there are children who are terrible sleepers, or the child who is totally out of control except when he's watching a screen, or what? So talk a little about the sort of the more challenging children. And
I alluded to it before. So, you know, the main example we have in child development of what it means to have poor executive function is ADHD. So practically speaking, the best way to think about ADHD is a developmental delay in executive function. Your self-management skills are behind, and one of the things those kids end up doing is, because symptoms of ADHD include poor attention management, easily bored, novelty-seeking, and generally prioritizing not so well, they get really sucked into screens. And there's studies saying they'll spend as much as 3 times a day on screens left to their own devices. At the same time, though, you know, there's research. I mean, it needs to be handled to me like a health concern, like nutrition, of a goal of getting them to have it as part of their lives and not all of their lives. But you have to work with families, too. So typically the way I work with it is I just ask parents to move towards the place where they're using technology as a tool, which is all that it is. So yeah, they need the relief to, you know, fly on a plane, or they need the relief to get dinner on the table. So they just set up the routines around the house more and more. So screen time is, you know, 5 to 6, and then you get the dinner on the table. But the open-ended screen time that many kids fall into, you know, it's really like, I think the running joke, and I think Perry and I have said this before, it's like, it's not, you know, years ago they used to think rock and roll was going to corrupt children, and as you know, and I'm a huge music fan, so I hope it's not true, but there's never really been any science about that, as opposed to, you know, screens and kids, which, you know, there are plenty of studies suggesting that, you know, and it's important subtlety. It's not that screens are inherently bad, they're just a tool. It's like, they just are, but what matters is whether they're used well, and parental involvement with screen time on its own correlates with lots of great things in kids. So you just need to be working with your kid, just like you would try to get them to have a healthy lifestyle in any other way, to just, you know, use it well and in its time, but not all the time, I think.
And I'd also add that, you know, difficult kid or easy kid, we're up against something that's, I mean, essentially, you know, been engineered to be as maximally addictive as possible, and only more so with each new iOS update that comes out. I mean, so, you know, I was thinking about, you know, back to, you know, like my behaviorism class in psychology many years ago, and the way that things come in on a screen are in what's called a variable rate reinforcement schedule, which is the hardest kind of conditioning to break. And so they are literally addictive. And the brains of a child and an adolescent don't have the impulse control to be able to even kind of be aware of how to control their impulses around it. And then they're also incredibly useful. I mean, I think about with myself, you know, okay, well, it's you know, I don't need a watch anymore because it's also my clock. And I go to the park with my son, and I'm like, oh, I don't need to bring my phone this time. Oh, but what if I want to take a picture? You know, and all these things. So it's always on us all the time.
The interesting thing, though, is if you have poor executive function, you're typically not going to use it in the way that makes it more useful. So it's a great tool to working with ADHD, but people with ADHD, kids with ADHD, need to be taught how to use it because they have poor organizational skills to begin with.
Yeah. So I would make two other comments about kids and screens. The first is, and this comes up a lot with Reach Out and Read, should you be giving them e-books? And we're actually giving the first books to children who eat them, so there are a whole lot of other issues. You know, 6-month-olds chew books, but I'm fond of traditional books for many reasons. But one of the things that I think it's important to say is we're not worried that our patients will not be able to swipe and click. When is the last time a child was brought to you because he just can't use the tablet? Right? That's not a problem. It's not going to happen. But the second point, and this is a point about a lot of parenting, whether we like it or not, is that in the end, they're going to win. Right? Whatever limits we set, whatever rules we make, when they're 22, they're going to be making their own rules. It's the same as sort of setting rules around, you know, can you take the subway by yourself? Can you be home? In the end, when they're 22. They can stay home alone. They can take the subway by themselves. So we all know where this is going in the end. Our job is to figure out, while we have power, how to, you know, how to use our powers for good, for niceness
power
instead of for evil.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, we all grew up on Batman.
But I think a lot of it, you know, like a lot of things in childhood, it's like we want, it's the environment you're raised in, really, that matters, you know, around any of these things, around nutrition, around exercise, around reading. I mean, one of the best, if you, you know, one of the things we haven't said directly yet, and I really, you know, I wanted to make sure we did, is like one of the other really, really proven things to help children succeed in life is reading in books. And if you want your child to be a reader, they just need to be raised around reading in books. And that, so the same thing goes for screen time. I mean, it's like, sure, they're going to leave your house and at some point do whatever they want. But if they've been raised in a balanced, you know, sort of environment that values being outside and, you know, sets limits around screens for yourself as much as them, not like, you know, I'm watching it all day long, but you can't, you know, that's, but just the big picture, then they're more likely to get to adulthood and have it in its place and recognize, like, I'm going to put it away for a while. I mean, there's so many studies about how, like there was a study recently looking at how having a smartphone on the table during a conversation disrupts conversation. You know, it's like, and so you can just make an active choice to say, like, oh, this is an important conversation, I'm going to put it away, you know.
The other thing that I found interesting, years ago I wrote about homework and some of the, I interviewed a bunch of people who study homework and what it's supposed to be, and I might like to come back to homework for a minute. But one of the things that was interesting is when you talk to functional adults and you get into this, they all know what they can do in what setting. And every single person I interviewed, because I started asking, I can edit in airports and on airplanes, but I can't write. But I can read other people's work. I can, you know, do this in a noisy setting, but for this I need quiet. I can do this when I'm tired and not fully alert, but I can't do that. And part of being a functional adult, since we're not all at our best in an optimal setting at all times, is kind of knowing how your brain works and what your abilities are. And you know, if you interview, like I actually started interviewing medical students. If you have to memorize something, what is the, and people who are successful as students or successful later on, they figure this out about themselves. Right. But in school, we sort of sometimes seem to assume that all children will be able to do the work in the same way.
Right. And actually, if you look at college students, one of the things you can see is that many of them, it often goes back to ADHD for me, but that's just my professional life. But most college students struggle to find how to study effectively. And then if you're with ADHD, your odds are about half. But it is a common thing that it's overlooked, is like these are skills, and you know, they don't always come naturally to everybody.
So we're going to start taking audience questions in a minute, so write down your questions. But I was going to ask you both, when should parents worry? When should they be coming to see you or coming to see you? What kinds of things or kinds of struggles should make parents worry that maybe something more than just the usual back and forth of family life is going on?
I mean, you know, in my field, the way I tend to filter that down to like one thought is that there's an incredibly wide range of typical development. And for any skill set, if a child is just persistently getting in their own way in some way, then it's worth talking about, you know, and that could be their language is delayed. That could be they're knocking over every child on the playground. That could be academically. But I think, you know, if you had to summarize all of it, it's like, yeah, typical development, as long as the expectations that the adults are placing are appropriate, should mean that, you know, you're not continually getting in your own way. So when it comes to executive function, in fact, you know, ADHD, part of the diagnosis is this stuff is going on to the point you're impairing your own life in some way. And you can look at social skills the same way and academics. And really, you know, even for ADHD, even though it's not often thought about that way, but across all these different parts of development, so many of the first interventions are just educational. Like, so if you can take the judgment out of it, and there's so much fear, and it all is totally understandable, but if you can get past that, so many of the interventions are just like trying to catch kids' language up, or trying to catch the learning up, or trying to help them with behavior, that, you know, if they're just chronically getting somehow in their own way, we should typically look into it, to me.
And I think similarly, I think when someone's unhappy for a while, when the kid's unhappy for a while, when they're making their peers unhappy for a while, they're making their teacher unhappy for a while, parents are unhappy for a while, then there's something going on. And that may not be the kid. It may be actually the parents that maybe need to think about their parenting style. The teacher needs to think about their teaching style. But I think that's kind of the sign to me of, you know, like bring a kid in and let's have a little consultation and kind of see what's going on and see where we can make some changes to create a kid that's a little happier, more resilient and thriving.
So playing off that, then this is the last thing I'm going to ask. We talked a little, you've talked a little about the academic setting. You've talked a little about the home setting. We also wanted to touch on social life and how these qualities that you're talking about or the lack of these qualities can get in the way for kids in terms of social life or how parents might see some of this playing out in terms of their kids' social lives. You want to say a little more about that?
I mean, I guess in terms of, you know, something like executive function deficits that Mark often talks about, I mean, that'll certainly get in the way of social functioning or being able to read social cues. If we spend all of our time as parents looking at our screen or our kids look at their screen, we don't understand how to read facial cues anymore. We don't understand how to make eye contact and really develop attachments and read other people's emotions and respond to them in real time, not just when it turns into an online bullying crisis or something like that. So that's, you know, to relate it to screens to some extent. Is that kind of answering your question?
I mean, there's a researcher named Russell Barkley who has been talking recently about how executive function probably evolved as part of our social development, because another definition of it is kind of the skills we use to meet goals through societally appropriate means. So it's not just goal setting all on our own. You can think about the debate tonight, you know, and there's somebody who's not necessarily, I won't. So the goal of executive function is to be able to follow the rule. You know, executive function is planning an organization and, you know, doing it in a way that gets along with the rest of the community is part of executive function. So when you look at executive function that way, you know, it's part of social development. It's why the average preschooler, you know, when they knock someone down on the playground isn't being antisocial in any way. They're just impulsive and want that toy. And it's just part of social development to learn to get past that. And then, you know, that capacity to, you know, interact with the world around us successfully relies a lot on executive function and the social skills we learn at home. And you know, and I do think you can overlap it a little. I mean, we don't have time for discussions of the difference between, you know, what's just a new social norm, like communicating by text versus where it's disruptive socially. But it's probably some of both.
Yeah. I'm going to collect the cards. Or are you going to collect the cards?
You want to take a question while we're doing it?
Yeah, somebody wants.
Does someone have a question while the cards are coming up? Does someone have a question they want to ask?
What do the studies reveal about kids who are on medication and they are diagnosed
with ADHD? With ADHD?
Any long-term studies?
Yeah. So the question is about the treatment of ADHD. So since I'm up there and have the opportunity, I do want to put that in context. The question is about ADHD medication and are there long-term studies? I mean, there's two things I would say. One is it's important always to look at the fact that medications fit into a much bigger picture of things that help with ADHD. They don't work entirely on their own, and that's an important concept. But really, on its simplest level, there is a small but growing body of research around ADHD that suggests that kids who take the medication younger are more likely to have typically firing brains as adults. So that's what the only long-term, there's no research now suggesting any cumulative side effects at the moment. And there is some research suggesting small studies, I wouldn't call it like proof yet, but there are a small group of growing studies suggesting that children who are, and to me that probably overlaps with neuroplasticity. So by supporting more typical brain functioning through childhood, that eventually hardwires itself. And then when you stop the medicine, that wiring is there. So that's really the only, at this moment in time, long-term implications seem to be they may actually help kids outgrow their ADHD, although that's not proof yet. That's just a few small studies. Yeah. I'd have to go back to the original studies, but mostly what they're talking about kids who get diagnosed in elementary. It's interesting because what they're looking at usually are young adults, all of whom are off medication for whatever reason. And those who reported through elementary and middle school trying the medication are more likely to be functioning more typically.
So let's stay with this and some of the other questions that came in around ADHD and medications. One question was about parents who are resistant mm-hmm. to getting a child tested for ADHD mm-hmm. and so, talking to parents
right.
about that.
Right. So that's a great question. So the question is, what about people who are resistant to even looking at ADHD? And I think to me that's part of the really unique, frustrating part about ADHD in our culture, is that there's so much judgment attached to it as a word or a diagnosis. And on a simple level, you know, it's just a different type of developmental delay, really. You know, kids have language delays, kids have motor delays, and kids have ADHD. And I think the most important thing to reframe about an initial diagnosis is that it's purely educational. You just want to know what's going on that might be causing a child to struggle, and it may be ADHD and it might not be ADHD. But if you know it's ADHD, just that knowledge changes so much. You know, the capacity to say that, to just roughly estimate this 8 or 9 year old, you know, they're not intentionally being difficult. They have the self-management skills probably of a 4 or 5 year old, completely changes things. And I hear that regularly. Like, you know, you'd look, like just around impulsive behavior, like recognizing that impulsive behavior, like a person who's being impulsive, a child who's being impulsive, isn't choosing to be impulsive. You know, often they know exactly what the rules are. They just don't have the impulse control to manage it. You know, they still need discipline and their behavior is still frustrating, but I often hear from parents that once we can start seeing it that way, it's like your relationship changes with that child a little bit. You know, you recognize more clearly that, oh yeah, he's not just trying to be, you know, really difficult. He just has no impulse control right now.
I'm always stunned. I've written several times about kids with ADHD, and, you know, in practice, I've followed kids for years who were so clearly, they and their families, struggling with this. And you write about it, and, you know, that invisible chorus of disapproving commenters, you know, it's all, if these parents would stop, you know, if these parents would set limits, if these parents would, you know, when I was a boy, this wasn't a problem. It's just...
It's horrifying.
Amazing. Everyone is. And you sit, you know, you sort of want to say, I wish you could spend an hour in a room with this kid.
Yeah.
And then I want you to tell me,
yeah,
you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's so unique to ADHD of just having to live with this extra level of judgment.
There were also, and I don't know if maybe you've said everything you wanted to say about the question, both the question of when do you think about meds, when do you start meds, and also just I'll say a question about relationship between some of these conditions, including ADHD, and the issue of later drug use.
Okay, so there's just two questions there, obviously. So first of all, when it comes to ADHD, I mean, broadly speaking, truthfully, there's two treatment models that don't disagree with each other in terms of the fact, but it's just an approach. Where in the United States, the actual textbook recommendation is to try medication in any elementary school child at diagnosis, although many of us don't agree with it. In Europe, the recommendation is to try the behavioral and parenting and educational interventions first, although it's not, the, you know, they agree with the research about the medication. They just think, like, we might as well try this first, and there's actually growing research suggesting that if you get the behavioral supports in place first, medication is more likely to be successful. So the answer is, I think, again, to me personally, you know, I always have to explain to parents what the actual recommendations in the United States are, because that's what they are. But I think personally it's just a family decision of, you know, have we tried everything we can try? You know, there's so many things that work with ADHD, parent training and behavioral therapy and educational interventions and exercise helps and getting sleep problems under control helps. I mean, there's so many things to try that it's just an individual choice of, you know, right now, are things improving or are they not? How severe is the situation? Although from a clinical point of view, they have been studied down to age 3. So it's just like, you know, you don't do it if you don't have to. No one should take medications they don't need. And then it's just an individual choice of, are we maxed out on all these things, I think, is what it comes down to. So that's how I try to work with it. I mean, most families don't want to. I mean, why would anyone want to try the medication right away if they don't have to? So you work with the other stuff first. In terms of drug use, what the research really very heavily suggests, and this has been looked at many times because it's such a concern, is that ADHD itself puts you at very high risk for substance abuse, and using ADHD medication normalizes that. I mean, that's the short answer.
Yeah.
So the treating ADHD medically makes your odds of abusing, you know, getting involved with something the same as any other teenager, whereas untreated ADHD, you know, depending on the study, like doubles or triples your risk.
And to go back to the question of kind of worth getting tested or not, I think getting tested can give so much good information about differential diagnosis. Is this ADHD, or is it anxiety that looks like impulsivity, or is it something else that's going on, or is there something else about your child's unique learning style that can respond better to a certain behavioral approach or different kinds of interventions, or to see whether medication might actually be the best course to take?
So I'm going to move us over. Here's a good general question to come back and reframe, asking in terms of executive function, mindfulness, and resiliency, give us a picture at the different stages, elementary school, middle school, high school. When you're looking at an elementary school student, what are we talking about when we talk about normally developing what's a legitimate expectation of an elementary school student in terms of executive function? What would mindfulness look like in an elementary school student? And what would resiliency look like? And then we're going to move on to middle school and high school.
They're all interrelated. I don't know that you want to. I'm trying to think. The way to think of it, I think it's easier to look at is looking at it as a progression, actually, because it's hard to, there's no number of, you should be able to organize 14 tasks in 27 minutes and then it's normal. I mean, you just can't quantify it that way. It's easier to break it into stages starting at the beginning, which is to say that in preschool, you are. Executive function, the entirety of it has to do with beginning capacity to pay attention longer, to defer gratification and control your impulses, to start taking the perspective of others, and not much more than that. So, and if you want to, I won't tie it to ADHD, I was going to, but I'll skip that this time. And then as you get to school age, the executive function skills you're looking for are the ones that do two things. They allow you to function well in a classroom. So what are your executive function skills going to develop through school and through elementary school to middle school is keeping track of your belongings, keeping track of your to-do list, managing your homework. On the other side of it, there's the social piece having to do with impulse control, taking the perspective of others more. We haven't touched on actually one of the most important ways to develop executive function and track it both is through imaginative play. So that probably the reason imaginative play evolved in the first place is to develop executive function and social skills. It's particularly important in the preschool set. And as you get older, what does imaginative play require? Keeping information in mind, flexible thinking, impulse control, taking the perspective of others. That's all executive function. So that as you move through school age, there's a play-based part, there's a social part, there's a planning part. And then as you become a teenager, it's again easier to just separate one from the other of like a teenager has a much bigger capacity to prioritize and plan and manage time and keep track of the big picture. And yet the step to look at is why aren't they adults? Because, the example of my friend, Roberto, there's another psychologist in Boston I know who always talks about his friend when he's giving talks like this. The moment he was allowed to, he got a tattoo of his face. When he was a teenager, and that's teenage planning in a nutshell. It's no perspective to say, maybe 6 years from now, that might not be the greatest thing to have.
Prioritize, they just have different priorities factors of the teenage.
Yeah, that's the difference. I think that in a nutshell is the difference between teen executive function and adult is you don't know how to, you can't plan for retirement yet. You can't necessarily plan, run a long-term project in the same skill set. It has directly to do with social media. I mean, sometimes, some of the stupid stuff teens do on phones, it's of course.
Yeah, before social media, we didn't do any stupid stuff.
No, I said specifically on phones.
My adolescent, there was none.
You know, the difference was, though, is you couldn't send it to everybody
Aren't
in your class all
at once. Aren't we all grateful there? My youngest son said to me, how come all the teachers say, I'm so glad there aren't any pictures from when I was in high school that you can see?
How could I be up here pretending to do this if there's pictures of what I used to do?
But Chris, you want to talk about the stages at all?
Mark is kind of really the executive function guy. I mean, I think in terms of where mindfulness and where, compassion or empathy development could go. I mean, I think, that also can start, we can start teaching some basic, kind of playful awareness practices to kids that are pretty young, a few sort of imaginative breathing practices, breathe in like you're smelling the hot chocolate, breathe out like you're cooling it off, something like that for age 3 or 4.
Well, actually, just so you know, you're answering another question, because one of the questions I was going to say was several people asked for concrete examples of practices we can employ with children of different ages and with teens to enhance mindfulness and reduce anxiety. So go into a little detail there.
All right, then. I think through play, which is, again, this kind of comes back to the importance of traditional play, not screenplay, in so many ways, but one of the best ways to develop executive function, there's a wonderful curriculum called the Tools of the Mind curriculum that's probably in a number of the local preschools and elementary schools, but they really emphasize play and the way play and imagination can be used to teach anything from planning and executive function even to mindfulness. So there's this wonderful researcher many, many years ago who was trying to get kids to stand still, Lev Vygotsky, some people might know him, and he did this study where he said, okay, guys, I want you to stand still. And what happens? The kids are running around all over the place, right? So then he says, okay, I want you to stand still. This time, imagine that you're the guard at a factory or a knight guarding a castle. And, of course, what do you think happens? Right? The kids can stand still for like 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and longer. And that's why things like visualization can be so powerful. Or if any of us do yoga or practices like that, it can be really helpful. So for younger kids, I was sort of starting, to kind of go there with this, just basic kind of breath regulation practice of use your imagination. What's going to be interesting to, think about breathing. Imagine you're smelling something. Breathe out like you're blowing to cool it off. Imagine you're smelling a flower. Breathe out like you're blowing a pinwheel. These kinds of things slow down the breath, allow us to pay more attention to the breath, and especially in young kids.
Yeah. And there's a great simple classroom practice that's a mindfulness practice of you just ring a bell and ask all the kids to raise their hand when they can no longer hear it. And it's just a practice that helps them settle some. When I talk about practicing mindfulness, I think sometimes it's easier to work from adults backwards because I think it makes it clearer where, with an adult, you can just start talking to them about mindfulness. So you're trying to, build the capacity to be, we didn't even talk about mindfulness much, to be more aware of what's going on moment to moment instead of just caught up in the distractions we're always caught up in and caught up in the reactions. So with an adult, you can just say that and then say, we're going to do a basic breathing practice that works on, focusing the attention. And then with teens, you can really talk about it a little bit the same way, except you got to translate it so it makes sense to them. You'd use different words, but conceptually it's the same. And then as you start moving down to younger and younger kids, you simplify, it's almost like teaching a sport or anything else. If you know it well enough, you simplify the language a little bit. But many middle school kids can understand basically following the breath some. I use it in my medical practice a lot for sleep. It turns out to be really boring to do. So it's great for sleep. You just have them, they're distracted, they're all over the place. You have them do this little mindfulness practice and they're out cold and, it works. And then when you get down to really, really young kids, you make it play, and you tell them to put a stuffed animal on their belly and rock the animal to sleep, or you tell them to blow on your fingers and see if they can make them move up. And one of the things that's happening there is it's just how the brain works, in that they're caught up in some thought that's causing them to freak out, they don't want to go to bed or whatever else, and you're just trying to, like we would try, when any of us, when we get stressed, it's all fight or flight, we're not thinking anymore, and we're just trying to focus our attention somewhere else for a moment so we can settle ourselves. So with a very young child, if you can catch them early enough, once they're in like true tantrum mode, it's like the teacher from Peanuts, they're not hearing anything. But if you can catch them and just divert their attention, it's just distraction on some level, I guess. You can just have them focus on breathing in some way. And then their brains settle, they get out of that stress mode, and maybe you can just, divert that tantrum or divert that behavior. And in young kids, that's just going to be, a few minutes of playful breathing in some way or another, like Chris was saying.
Right, or focusing on the senses, I think, is really great. Our thoughts are kind of racing to the future, stuck in the past, or all over the place, but our five senses are really always able to ground us in the present through mindful eating, mindful listening, and we can do the mindful. I brought a bell, so people signed up for mindfulness if you want.
Okay.
We can just ring the bell, and I'll invite you to close your eyes and just open them when you can no longer hear the sound of the bell. So we can start with that. in just that 20, 25 seconds, just noticing any change in, you know, awareness of how you're feeling, how your body, your mind is feeling, and also just kind of the tone in the room has actually shifted in just that short practice, too.
There were a number of questions about incorporating some kind of mindfulness exercise, which I think you've answered well. One person who asked a question brought up if there's more than one child, if there's a family of two small children described as one spacey, one high energy. Want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think there's one bigger comment around mindfulness and family you have to start with, which is that, you know, 75% of mindfulness with family is just parents practicing mindfulness. So before you start telling your busy child or your quiet child, you know, it's your turn for mindfulness, kids learn just, it really comes back to, I think, what we were talking about way at the beginning of how much kids are learning from their environment. So even before you worry about specific mindfulness practices for kids, a lot of it is just how you're living it yourself, you know. And that's a large part of the answer often in young kids, because you can't make anyone meditate. You can't make anyone practice mindfulness. You can just sort of introduce it and hope it catches on, in essence. So I think that would be the first place I would start with. I don't know if you want to...
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the best way to create mindful kids is to surround them with mindful adults, basically. You know, if you want stressed out kids, be stressed out yourself and, you know, stress out their teachers as well. So, which I'm sure everyone's capable of doing. But I do think that's, you know, that's where to start. That's kind of the foundation. And then maybe it is inviting them in. Or let's just try the first, you know, three bites of our meal tonight. Maybe it's a holiday or maybe it's not or something like that, by just really, you know, using all of our senses. You know, what's one smell? What's one, you know, taste you can taste? And what's, you know, the sound of it, you know, whatever it might be, or just other kinds of mindful practices.
And one other thing Chris and I haven't said specifically is that mindfulness doesn't mean stillness at all.
Right.
So especially in very young kids, you can do a lot of different mindful movement exercises. I mean, from yoga to just like pretend you're seaweed stuck to the ocean floor is a common one in a couple of programs. So if you have a child who's really wiggly, then you do it really wiggly. You know, you can't make them sit still.
And I think
there's no need to.
Right. Making things a game, making them a competition too can be fun. I mean, I remember, you know, I'd never learned the word mindfulness till I was in college, but I look back on childhood and it's like, oh, at nature camp, we'd go and walk in the woods as quietly as possible. They called it walking like an Indian, which is no longer politically correct. But it's like, you know, walk as quietly as you can. That takes a tremendous amount of focus, right? Can I make as little noise as possible? I'm really focusing on every footstep. Do that for a couple minutes next time you're out taking a hike or just walking down the street. These little things actually just bring a lot more awareness to everything that we're doing.
I'm going to move us over to screen time, but the first screen time question is going to be about mindfulness apps and
yes,
whether there are mindfulness apps that you believe in.
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, mindfulness is just like physical exercise. And, you know, one of the better uses of a smartphone is that you're, you know, to develop – mindfulness is not something – and, you know, one of the misunderstandings that sometimes come out, like, you don't use it when you're stressed specifically – because that's kind of like trying to like lift up a television set if you don't have the strength to lift up a television set. You know, if you want to become a mover of television sets, you want to go to the gym long enough for a few months so that you get stronger, so you start being able to move big, heavy things. So mindfulness is just a practice so that stress becomes easier to manage over time. You know, it's not a specific goal. It's just about long-term fitness. So if a mindfulness app helps to remind you daily to just do a little mindfulness practice, that's perfect. And I have a bunch listed on my website. There's almost too many to count nowadays. Sometimes I joke, it's about finding the right accent for you. There's a British program, there's an Australian program, there's a few American programs. You just got to find the voice that connects for you and just do it every day and then see what happens after a few months.
The best mindfulness app is the one your kids will use.
Yeah. I mean, there are only a couple that are geared at kids specifically. I mean, we can mention those.
And I've got a little device called a Spire. Some people may have seen it. They sell them at like the Apple store and stuff. But it's like a Fitbit, and it also measures your breath. And it actually connects to your phone, and then it buzzes you when you're getting tense. And it says, "You seem tense. Take a few breaths." and it gives you all these, you know, sort of like, you know, biometric data and stuff if you want to really kind of geek out on you know. But it's interesting because it can say to me, oh, like I notice I'm most stressed out at these particular times of day, or when I'm stuck in traffic, or when I'm, you know, interacting with this particular in-law or whatever it might be. I can, you know, then I can kind of be proactive, which is also what mindfulness is about, being responsive, not reactive, being proactive even to like, oh, I know I'm going into this situation that's going to stress me out. How do I take a few breaths before I walk in the door? So that's kind of a neat app.
Yeah, and just in terms of picking apps, it really is just like exercise. I mean, some people go to the gym, some people run, some people bike. It's like finding what fits for you that's being taught authentically. I mean, there is one I come back to a lot just because it breaks it up by age called Smiling Mind, but it's not because, you know, they're necessarily inherently better than everybody else. It's just that the app itself breaks down nicely by like 7 to 12, 12 to 18, and 18 and up. So.
There's also a question about how worried you find parents to be about screen time, and are parents parents be more worried? Should we all be more worried? Should more parents be worried? What do you think?
I mean, I personally feel quite strongly that screen time has become just as important as nutrition and exercise in our country. And I'm not sure Perry and Chris agree quite as strongly, but I think. It's not. It is like nutrition or exercise. There's no exact number for everybody, and yet there's a healthy place in our lives, and there isn't. And because it's a product that's being very closely monitored to make sure it hooks our kids as much as possible, and because there is research correlating more and more time with not great outcomes in child development, I do think it's important that parents are directly involved in it. They just and there's no I don't know what there can't ever be a strict limit. In terms of time, as much as just looking at the big picture and making sure it isn't always the fallback and all day long. Monitoring content by age is quite important. But it's just, you just got to be really involved as a parent to keep it healthy and safe. You just can't assume your kids are going to do it themselves.
And I think there are, I think every family has to kind of figure out their own limits, but there are some simple ways of just thinking, can this not be at the dinner table? Are there screen-free, sort of like rooms in the house or times of day that we can have? I think part of what's hard is the cat is out of the bag. Our kids, got this stuff, when they were young. I think there probably will be regulations the way there are around, kids and substances and kids and other behaviors and stuff like that at some point. But the product arrived first. I try myself and, encourage families also trying to stay away from it before bedtime, stay away from it being the first thing we look at in the morning, which is really hard if anyone just updated their iPhone. It has a whole sleep function that tells you how great you're sleeping, and it'll wake you up at this time to get back on your device again, but not at the dinner table or not at certain other times, if that is possible for your family. I do really encourage that. And following those rules ourselves.
And a tech bedtime is a great thing.
Yeah.
It just like everything goes to its charging station at some point in the household.
Yeah, we do that, putting the devices to sleep for the night before you put the kid to sleep for the night. Doesn't always work, but, all right, we had a couple of questions about schools. One question about, other than extremely bad schools and extremely poor schools, how much of a difference does it really make which school you go to? And another question about how teachers in an elementary school setting can help students with executive functioning, including students with ADHD.
Do you want me to go first?
I know you,
Chris,
both work with schools.
Yeah,
so.
Do you want to go first or me, Chris?
I think if you're looking at choosing schools, I think what you want to most look at is the teachers and the relationship that the teachers have with the kids. Not necessarily look at the technology or every kind of aspect of the facility, but really that relationship between the teachers and kids is going to be, to my mind, the teacher is going to be able to pick up, is this kid starting to develop a learning issue? Is this kid starting to, develop a social issue or an emotional issue? And they're also going to have a rapport where the kid feels safe enough to learn. That's coming again from the sort of emotional wellness, psychological side of it. But I think really looking at teachers, and what we know also about the research on good teachers and bad teachers is that a good teacher can get a kid through almost 2 years of material in a year, while an equivalent fourth grade teacher, the kid may get through half of that material, even with similar students in the class. So it's really about the teachers.
I think there's two things to look at that really go for all children. I mean, so a lot of when you talk about ADHD, with that question had both in it, are things that really work for all kids. They just become more vital for kids with ADHD. And so on the one, there's two things I think that are important to look at. On the one hand, there's the concept of just how do you build executive function in kids who are school age? A lot of it is just through consistency and routine and instruction in terms of, you know, reminders for one thing, you know, routines that teach that, and time management and teaching project management. But some of it's much more intricate. Like the core of narrative writing is executive function. And, you know, there's a big trend going on in writing nowadays of just like, you know, you learn to write through just blank page writing. And it turns out that if you don't have strong executive function, that's really, really hard. So when it comes to ADHD specifically, well, I would say, first of all, from my perspective, working in the field of education, you know, that direct instruction in how to write makes better writers in general. But, you know, when it comes to executive function and ADHD very specifically, you know, the part executive function is how you do problem-based learning. Executive function is how you organize your thoughts in a classroom. Executive function's been linked to reading comprehension. Executive function's been linked to narrative writing disorders. So really, for kids with ADHD, if you're going to help them thrive in a classroom, more, you know, traditional educational techniques where they just get direct, direct instruction and fluency in the basics. Because once you're fluent in an academic task, it's not calling on executive function in the same way anymore. That's why some kids with ADHD can become hyper-focused readers. So there's a symptom of ADHD where you hyper-focus, you know, that's the video game problem in essence. But you can see hyper-focused readers. What's happened there? Reading has become such a fluent skill that they just get sucked into their books, which obviously isn't a bad thing, although it can be. I mean, the kids' parents complain sometimes, like, you won't go in the backyard. So it's perfectly healthy, but you're seeing that same tendency to hyper-focus because reading is no longer an executive function-based skill. And in fact, one of the first studies of neuroplasticity, which is the ability of the brain to rewire itself, looked at reading disabilities. And they showed that in people with reading disabilities, they use the front part of the brain, they use the executive function part of the brain to read because they're problem-solving. And once it's a fluent skill, they use the back part of the brain, which is all the rote stuff. And that is really across the board what helps with ADHD. You know, if you can teach project management till it's rote, if you can teach reading until they have the building blocks down, writing so that they have an organizational routine in their head, math facts, you know, that traditional approach to learning gives them the foundation so that they can then do all the funky, cool, progressive, creative things. But they need that foundation first because that's all executive function-based stuff.
So I have one question which I'm going to answer. You can weigh in. And then I'm going to ask you the last question, which is going to be what I think in the debate we would call your closing statement. So the question I was going to answer was, what books do you recommend for preschool children to help with feelings? And I was just going to say, pretty much all good picture books are great. What little children need is they need a chance to talk about and understand the feelings. So why is Where the Wild Things Are such a wonderful book for preschool children? Because it's about getting really mad and acting out and having all kinds of adventures, and there are great facial expressions, and there are monsters, which are supposedly based on Sendex relatives. And, you know, and then, of course, at the end of the book, all is forgiven and, you know, your supper's waiting. But I mean, basically, my overall feeling about children's books is that, you know, they don't need morals. They don't, you know, we generally, at least reach out and read, every week somebody sends in a book which is called something like, Susie Learns That It's Bad to Be Mean. Right? And it's usually self-published. And somebody's written a book in which, you know, the worst one was about not playing in the street because that child got run over on every page. But, you know, but just stories about family life in which people have feelings and you can talk about the feelings and, you know, why is she angry? Why is he crying? Why does he want what the other child has? That's the fun part. And to me, a big part of it is just having the language to talk about feelings. Not any particular moral, but just the fun of recognizing that even the little animals on the page, that one's angry, that one's happy, that one's smug.
And that's what the research really showed. I'm just doing another writing project and kind of reading about this. But when kids are able to identify with us as parents, oh, what's this kid feeling? Why are they feeling it at like age, you know, if you're doing that as a parent at age 18 months, by 4 and 5, they're actually exhibiting more pro-social behaviors. Right. They're compromising, they're sharing, they're showing more empathy for their peers. So reading is just so
powerful.
All right. So for I'm going to ask you now for those closing statements. These were questions we had. Basically, how can parents improve their own executive function skills to better teach their children? We had the same question about mindfulness. It's kind of, and I think it's probably a good note to end on, what can, you know, if we as parents are thinking about these skills, what can we, if we look at ourselves first, but with the aim of helping our children, you know, what would you like, how would you like to...
Sure. You want to go?
Sure, go ahead.
You know, I think one of the most important things as an adult, as a parent, to just always do is just remember that you have to take care of yourself enough to take care of your kids, because stress and burnout, if nothing else, affect executive function. So I think if you want to start taking care of yourself and your executive function, there's the, just like with kids, there's the general side of it of just like, I mean, I've used this a lot because it was so important to me, is like going into medical school, someone told me, you know, whatever they do to you, find one thing that keeps you sane and don't let go. And the same thing goes for parenting of like, you know, you have to take care of yourself enough in general. Like your kids still come first, but you got to find that thing that keeps you grounded, and that's part of the answer. And then the second piece of it that ties all this together for me, that professionally is what got me interested in these things that seem so different, is that neuroplasticity works. If you practice mindfulness, if you practice things that build executive function, your executive function skills improve. So just committing to do that has been shown to assist with all sorts of aspects of health and executive function at any age. So that, I think that's how I would summarize that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it does go back so much to self-care and sort of the, you know, what's the, you know, on the, when you're on the airplane and, you know, they say the oxygen mask comes out, you know, like put it on yourself first and then put it on your child. I mean, I think that's so, you know, it's kind of trite, but it's so true for parenting. You know, maintaining, you know, other aspects of your identity also beyond being a parent, as much as, you know, that's remotely possible to do, I think is really helpful to have, you know, to continue to try to live as, you know, kind of broad a life as possible, and just having some self-compassion and self-forgiveness and forgiveness with yourself. That's going to, I think, be so key to your kids learning that as well, because what the research really shows is like, you don't have to be a perfect parent. You know, the other kind of line that comes up a lot in training of psychologists is this idea of the good enough parent. Like, you just have to be good enough. You don't have to be perfect. You know, I also just was hearing, so I guess it was at the end of Angela Duckworth's book, but, you know, are you trying to raise your kids for greatness or for goodness? Like, which is your priority? And really kind of asking yourself that question, I think, can be a helpful one to remember as well.
Well, and I think just then, thank you. Thanks to both of you. And I would just say, finally, one of the lessons of practicing pediatrics, in general pediatrics, is just the dailiness of being a parent. It's the sort of getting up every morning and taking it on again and eventually getting to go to bed at night and then, you know, starting over again. And I think there are lessons here from what you're saying in terms of enjoying the process, being surprised by the process, occasionally being taught a lesson that you didn't expect to learn when your children diverge from the script, which they are supposed to do and will inevitably do. But be, you know, some of what you're being mindful of, some of what you're being aware of are actually the not all delightful, but very interesting surprises of that daily responsibility. Anyway, thank you all so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks. Perry, I wanted to hear your final statement, so thank you for adding that. Thanks to our wonderful speakers, and thanks to all of you for coming.